Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Heretics Hour on this lovely June 30th evening, 2014. It's been a gorgeous, breezy day here where I am, but we're now headed into the dog days of July, August, and September. However, we do have a good start on rainfall, so one can hope, it will also go by fast. I know that because time has been going by very fast. We're already halfway through this year of 2014, and what can I say about that? That really sped by. I want to thank Ron Johnson. I didn't say who I am. I didn't give my name, did I? I'm Carolyn Yeager, your host here on the Heretics Hour, every Monday at this time, 8 p.m. Central Time. And I want to thank Ron Johnson for his donation this past week. Very kind of him. Another new person that I'm happy to get to know. I looked up his town. He's from, I didn't write it down here, but he's from Pittsfield, New York. Oh, I shouldn't have given his last name. I'm sorry about that. I wrote it down here. I shouldn't have done that. Maybe you'll all forget about it. Anyway, I have reached, he might not mind, I don't know. I have reached the, another little announcement that I have reached the 200,000 mark on Alexa. Just on a hunch, I was at 2002, I was at 2003, then 2002, and I've been willing myself to come down to the 200,000 mark ever since the end of the white network was taken offline, and not taken offline, but closed down. I finally got there. I just checked right before the show, and it had moved a little further down, and now it's at 200,500. So I have arrived at my goal, and now I'll have to make a new goal, but I arrived at my goal that I made 2.5 months ago when the White Network had reached 200,000 for the first time, and I thought that was, well, Tan did too. We thought that was so great, just fantastic. It was a little bit, just a little bit above that at that time. Then it was at 200,000, excuse me, before that April 15th, and I was, CarolynYeager.net was a little over 400,000. I had been down into the 300,000, high 300,000s level, maybe 379,000 or something, but then I went back up again. Going up is not good, going down is good. This is the global rank, so I thought, well, now that people have to come to my network for my programs and for everything, since people were going to the White Network to find out about me and what I was doing and to listen to my shows and stuff, I'll see. I should be able to bring my number down. And it did start going down almost right away, and it went down quite a bit, and it's just continued. And it took 2.5 months to come down half again what it was, to come down to one half what it was, and it's come down from 400 to 200,000. So I'm pretty thrilled about that because I didn't, at one point, I really didn't think I'd make it to that. I thought, well, you know, it would be nice, but I was so far away from it. But it's amazing. And I've been having excellent traffic on my site, and I thank all the people who keep coming back, and I hope you continue to keep coming back to see what's on CarolynYeager.net, and I try hard not to disappoint you and try hard to keep something new there, but it's difficult to do too much. I feel like I'm stretched in already, and there are a lot of things that I need to do that have nothing to do with my website, and I'm not, some of them do have something to do with my website, actually. And it's hard to get more done than the three radio programs I do. So that's the difficulty there. But anyway, I do my best. And I want to also say that I'm at 54,000 in the U.S. That's pretty good, better than I used to be. And I have more and more United States visitors to my site. They're taking up the majority on a larger way than they used to. I used to have higher percentage of British, United Kingdom. Either the United Kingdom people are some of them are deserting me, or I've just got more and more from the United States, which is changing the ratio. But in any event, the average time on my site as of today, this evening, was 3.5 minutes. It used to be better than that, but I don't know how accurate they are on any of that. And as my ranking comes down, they should become more accurate rather than less accurate. So on all the other things, and pages per view is 2.6 pages per view. I used to have be in the 5 and 6. I don't know, again, if that was accurate, or if I've got more people now who come for shorter times just checking, and that might be affecting that. Anyway, I'm not somebody who's gaga over Alexa, because I don't think that they're all that accurate, actually, but they've got to be some kind of indicator. And I do know that they're reflecting what's happening on my site accurately now, because I know it has been improving, continuing to improve. It started improving right away, so it maybe just takes a while for the numbers to come down, because it's been very good for this whole period of time, actually. My traffic and the reads on my blog posts and so on. Well, my topic tonight, ladies and gentlemen, is National Socialism, what it is and what it is not. And I don't know how interested a lot of you are in this. I've talked about it many times in the past already. Why am I going back to it again? Well, three things happened since Friday to bring me to this topic, and I am somebody who tends to, leading up to a program, things that come up take hold of my mind in a stronger way than something that I've been thinking about doing before that or for a long time. I'm still waiting to do this program on Richard Sorge, the communist Soviet spy, and those British, other British spies that he was loosely connected with. But other things come up, and I feel a kind of a passion to talk it out. So I'm doing this today, and I'm also going to include some of my genealogy that I've been working on in this past week. And I'll tell you about that in the second hour. So, but these three things are that made me want to talk about National Socialism some more were my show with Alex Davies on Saturday. And I'm not here at all to criticize Alex at all. In fact, I think that while I have a little bit of difference, I think he's probably doing the right thing from his point of view, and for what he's trying to accomplish, and also who he is. And, you know, I have to remember, I do remember, I never forget, that I'm quite a bit older than a lot of these people. You know, Alex is only 19 years old, and I'm quite a bit older than that. So he sees things from a different perspective, and he is seeing National Socialism as a world view. That's what I got. As I tried to kind of condense down the program into what he was actually saying, what he actually informed me about, that I was looking for some answers about this from him. And basically, National Socialism is something that any nationalist can adopt, including Poles and Russians who, Poles and Russians who believe in the Holocaust, but it's because they want to believe in the Holocaust, and they believe in other German atrocities. So I have a little bit of a problem with this, which I expressed on the program. But how this fits together, because if National Socialism is something that people want to adopt, and if Germans created this wonderful worldview, and of course you can argue that they didn't, that it's older than that, and it started out here and there, and it, you can bring in many things, but if we want to talk about the National Socialism as the Germans carried it out in Germany, in the Third Reich, then it's like they did this good thing, but as soon as the war came along, then they turned bad. So, this is the thing that this doesn't have a very clear answer as far as I'm concerned. And I would also ask why these people, speaking of the Poles and the Russians and others similar to that, why they can't see through the Jews better than they do, and why they still want to defend the Jews. Now, these few people that are in the white nationalist type, or say that they're National Socialists, they're probably not defending Jews, but so many of their countrymen are, and they are really not they don't feel too free to say anything about the Jews, so they kind of ignore that issue. And these are serious problems for me if you're a National Socialist. The biggest problem is not with Alex. I admire Alex. I think he's doing great, better than by far most in his worldview, keeping his worldview. So I just brought him up because of that, what I just said. I won't repeat it. Then the next issue I had was with, not an issue at all, but a very minor little experience with Arthur Topham of, what is Arthur's website, darn it? Boy, I can't remember anything. And I didn't put it down here. His, something about, who Arthur Topham is from Canada. I hope you do. I was looking at over his website. I keep wanting to call it Rebel something, but Rebel, that's not it. Something close to that. He had a little blog post there with a quote from Mein Kampf by Hitler about, how he was a Christian and how he... real strong pro-Christian statement that he made, which came from a 1922 speech, and I've quoted it myself in the past, but on Arthur's blog post there, it was attributed to Mein Kampf, not to the speech that Hitler gave, and it's all a piece of artwork. It's all like Photoshopped, so you can't correct it. You can't just change the attribution on it. You'd have to redo the whole artwork. But I saw that there, and so I left a comment, and I wrote that corrected it. And then I got an email from Arthur, and he said to me, "Thanks for correcting that error, Carolyn. The person I received it from stated that it was from Mein Kampf. For the record, though, it's good to know precisely where it originated from. It also reinforces the fact that Hitler was a Christian." No, that's what he wrote on the website. I'm sorry. Oh, I better wake up here. He wrote to me and he said, "Hi, Carolyn, thanks for correcting that error regarding the quote from Hitler. The person who sent it to me referenced it to Mein Kampf. But in the interest of historical accuracy, it's essential to keep it correct." Well, so I thought, that was a couple days ago. I thought today I'd just go over there and look and see if it was still there or if it had been changed. But then I realized when I saw it there that it couldn't be changed. But my comment was there, and then there was a reply from Arthur on his website there, under that thing. And it's the one where there's a cross on it. And he said, "My something as a Christian, and is very, very, very strongly pro-Christian, this whole statement. And it was presented in a very Christian-like way. So Arthur sent that. I saw that Arthur had written a comment there. And it's the one I already read you. But you see, it's a little different from what he sent to me. He said that, in the first place, somebody sent it to him and said it was from Mein Kampf. Either someone said that and Arthur made that artwork, or the person sent the artwork. I don't know. But Arthur didn't check it out, and that's understandable. He liked it. He wanted to believe it. And so if you want something to be true, you often don't check to find out that it's not, because you don't want to find that out. So that's very human. But on the website, instead of saying that in the interest of historical accuracy, it's essential to keep it correct, he said, for the record, though, it's good to know precisely where it originated from. It also reinforces the fact that Hitler was a Christian. He didn't say that to me, because I said in mine that Hitler didn't write that in Mein Kampf, because he didn't want to put something like that in a book, but he didn't mind saying it in a speech. I didn't say it exactly that way, but that's what I meant. I mean, he was saying those things in his speeches, but he didn't put them in Mein Kampf. So then I thought, since I was saying that Arthur didn't check it out before he put that there, and still leave it there the way it is, with my comment there, I thought maybe I should go and check out Mein Kampf. It's been a long time since I read it, and I didn't remember anything in Mein Kampf really about Christianity. I didn't recall that Hitler had written about it. And indeed, I looked in the index and only found two things under Christian. I looked under Christian, and there was a Christian and there was a Christianity. Or they were both Christian, I don't know. But the first one was from where he was talking. The word Christian wasn't even used. But he was talking about, he mentioned the religion of love, the founder of the religion of love, and said some things. But he didn't ever say Christianity, and of course he wasn't saying anything like that he was, that he agreed with all that or anything. Just anyway, that's all that was. Then the other reference was actually to the Christian Socialist Party, and that's where the word Christian came in, and he was talking about how the Christian Socialist Party was more successful than I think it was his party at a certain point in time, because what they were doing, they were taking care of people's social needs, Christian Socialist Party, you know, taking care of people's social needs, which meant a lot to, made people, you know, like them. That's all that was. So there's no place in Mein Kampf that Hitler talks about being a Christian, which is probably a big disappointment to people who like to quote a lot of those things he said in speeches. And I used to quote those things too. And I'm not against it. I'm whatever the truth is about Adolf Hitler. If Adolf Hitler was a real, true or genuine Christian person in his beliefs, I'd be the first one to insist on that. But I'm finding more and more that I don't think that's true. And so this was something where this is just another example in my mind of telling the truth or passing on the truth, the truthful record, to our people out there, about Hitler and National Socialism, which to me are intertwined and combined and can't be separated. But a lot of people do see National Socialism as something that can stand on its own, that Hitler was just one exponent of it or proponent of it, and he had his version. But it doesn't have to include him, and it doesn't have to be the way he did it. It could be, you know, a different, as long as you're has to do with nationalism and caring about the people in your own nation. So anybody can be any, let's say, any European peoples can say, I'm National Socialist, and they can be in any nationality and want that for their own nation and done in their own way. It doesn't have to be done the way Hitler did it. Whereas for me, if you're going to say National Socialist, it should be Hitler's National Socialism. Now, I can see the other side's argument perfectly well, and I see that I'm just probably biased, maybe. But there's also a lot of reasons why it's confusing, and it doesn't help. I don't think it helps us to get ahead in any way by interpreting things that have had a very definite usage by interpreting them in other ways because you like to do it that way. I think we need to have more clarity than that. So I'll go on with the third one because I'm probably talking about this too much already. The third one was that I was decided to listen to another installment of the German Enclave program on ANN Radio with host Stefan Timm. And I saw that 3 weeks ago, I saw he had Jim Hardpecka as his guest, and they were going to talk about esoteric Hitlerism or something. So I thought, oh, I have to hear this and see what they're talking about. Well, I found it really kind of insane, but I did go ahead and sometimes I'm really looking for something to listen to while I'm doing something. And so I go there and I see what they have. And so I listened to the second one, and then that caused me today, just today, I think it was today, I listened to, it was yesterday, I listened to the third one they had, and they're still going at it. And they're talking about underground Nazi bases in the Antarctic and all around the world and, you know, all of this. I've mentioned it to a few people and told them that I think that they don't have any evidence, or it's all just dreams, you know. It's all just make-believe stuff. And they admit that, and they say, well, we just got this off the internet, you know, people are saying these things. It could be true. And then they go on and talk about it like it is true. So I listened again, and I was glad I did, because at the end of the show, towards the end of the show, somebody called in, and they took the call, and this person was, one of those real casual, yeah, how you doing, guys? And, you know, instead of just coming right up with what he called about, he starts in with this, you know, you go, you doing all right? Stuff like that. And then he finally says what he's calling about, which is not exactly what they've been talking about, but somebody that, I forget what. But anyway, he described himself as mixed, meaning mixed race. He doesn't say race, but he says he's mixed. But he thinks that, whatever he thinks that, you know, people aren't treating him right, or they weren't treating some friend of his right who wanted to talk about something on some show he called into. And the host was treating him politely, but finally they were tried to dismiss him. And when he was finally gone, Jim comes back. You know, Jim gets real excited, you know. And I wrote down everything he said word for word, so I'm going to quote it here. He says, is he gone? Are we back now? He says, well, here's the thing. I think we need to get away from this white, because, I mean, how do you define white? I go with Aryan. There are good people in all races, you know? Not only the white race, but the Asians, even some mixed people. We got to get away from the white thing because, you know, what is a white? You know, how do you define it? Here in Tennessee, there's people mixed with Indian blood. They got black blood in them. I mean, here's the thing. What we're looking for is a noble society, a noble Aryan society. Aryan means noble. Later, after that, was he got cut off. Other fellow wanted to talk, and he kept trying to break in, and finally he succeeded. So then Jim was quiet for a while he talked about how the other races could how the other races could be handled, but he didn't want to mix with them. And then Jim says, I think we can improve every race through eugenics. Every race can be improved through eugenics. Well, this is a typical thing that kind of fits in with the other two that I was talking about. Whereas people are going their own way in their thinking. Jim Reinhardt, a.k.a. Jim Hardpicka, he calls himself Jim Reinhardt now, calls himself every kind of thing. He calls himself a National Socialist, but yet he's into spiritualism in a big way, New Age type thinking. But I was quite surprised to find him even question, say, we got to get away from white. He doesn't want to turn anybody away. He wants to see everything on a spiritual plane and not on a physical plane. That's basically, in a nutshell, I guess. And this is what is done so much with this esoteric Hitlerism, esoteric Nazism, and so on. They want to say that National Socialism is spiritual, and therefore anybody can access it spiritually. And if you're a noble soul, it doesn't matter what race you are or what nationality you are, or who or what you are. If you have all these good qualities, then you're an Aryan. If you're Aryan, you can be a National Socialist, and we can all work together in this thing. Because Jim is saying, you know, we need everybody, and we want noble people, and these people can be noble too, and on and on. There's a whole lot of people who I read this in comments too often for my comfort, that National Socialism is about noble qualities in people, and it has nothing to do with race, with nationality, with any of these things. When you get right down to it, anybody can be a part of it if they're the kind of person that a National Socialist is supposed to be. And so this is what it is, which it isn't what it is. I just want to say that I suppose that a lot of these people think that it's important that people have a good feeling about Adolf Hitler, and the details don't really matter. As long as people feel good about Adolf Hitler or feel good about National Socialism or, you know, have a good opinion, say positive things about it. It doesn't matter who they are or where they're coming from or how well they understand it, if they have their own ideas about it. And this is where I can go along with the first part of that, but I can't go along with the second part of it. It just doesn't work if you carry this to its ultimate extreme or its ultimate conclusion. To be a real National Socialist, you have to, in my opinion, you have to be ready to defend Adolf Hitler and the German National Socialist state that he formed. Otherwise, you're just taking abstract ideas as a nationalist and applying them to your own situation. And for example, I've gotten another example here, as I seem to be tonight ready to bring up people that everybody knows, and I don't mean to be rude in doing this, but just pointing out some of the things that I think can be a problem. And that is it was kind of fun, though, the Daily Stormer banner contest. At the Daily Stormer, Andrew Anglin announced, I do believe it was on the 28th, that he was having a contest for a new banner for the Daily Stormer website. And he says he's made the executive decision to do this. But then, as not so executive, he says, though I am a fascist and we openly promote Hitler and National Socialism constantly on this site, several people have told me that the bombers are offensive to British people, and I have decided this is fair enough. He has decided this, he says. He made an executive decision, but it's because people told him that these bombers were offensive to British people. Several people, he says. Well, before I go any farther, I'm going to say that this has been settling in my mind. I've been reading the comments to this article, which some of them are kind of, there are a lot of difference of opinion there. And I have realized today that I don't think that Andrew is being truthful here. I don't believe that this is the reason that he's decided to change the banner. I think he's decided he wanted to change the banner, and he needed to come up with something, some reason to do so. So he came up with Brits complaining about the German planes that are on the banner. Because I can't imagine any Brits who are people who regularly read Daily Stormer who would complain about such a thing. I mean, I could be wrong, but I really don't think so. And I do think that Andrew wants to retire this banner because it is totally National Socialist. Everything on it and everything about it is National Socialist. And that's not what he wants the site to be any longer. And he doesn't want people to see it as that way any longer. And I don't disagree. I don't have a problem with that. I think he should change the banner. In fact, I've been saying he should do it for at least a couple of months. But in writing that in some comments on his site, I haven't written a comment for a long time. Well, I did not too long ago. I wrote one, but I was, and people got real mad at me for saying that because that was at the time that he was putting all those Putin posts on and wanting the freedom to support Putin, Vladimir Putin, even when Putin passed new laws banning Holocaust denial and even any World War II revision from the Nuremberg tribunals. I mean, really kind of awful stuff. And that was after Andrew had written all these fantastic praising promo pieces on Putin as being the next, you know, leader of the white race. He denies, he says that, but he's definitely implying that. And wanting everybody to think well of, you know, and follow Putin. And even after Putin did that, he didn't like it, but he didn't know what to say, but he kept, he didn't reject Putin. And then at some point he just quit putting things on there about Putin. And he saw that Putin wasn't going to be the person he thought he was going to be. He hoped he would be. And so that's been set aside. Although it could be picked up at any time, in my opinion. And so I said, if you're going to, you know, the way that you are talking all the time, Andrew, you need to get rid of that banner because it's false. It doesn't represent your site here, and it doesn't represent you. And now he's decided that it doesn't. And he wants to change it. And as I said, I'm fully in agreement with that. I'm glad he's come to that conclusion. And I hope people don't change his mind about it because a lot of the people writing comments are saying, oh, don't change it. Leave it just as it is. Well, there's no point in having a banner like that on a site like what the Daily Stormer is and is becoming more and more like a Jeff, like it's, you know, it's along the same lines as Jeff Rentz, as Rivera, what's his first name, and as some of these sites where you have something for everybody. You know, Andrew even said in a comment today that, let's see, I have it here. He said that this site is about spreading information to millions of people. And he said that in the past, he said he used to say we need to reach millions of people, which is why he's got a site of the type that he has. We need to reach millions of people. We don't want to talk to the people that are already on board. We want to reach all these other people. And that's what he's trying to do with that site. But he started out trying to convince people that he was both a fascist and a national socialist. And therefore, he wanted to be hardcore along those lines and appear to be hardcore. But that's finally worn away, and he's finally admitting that's not what he's about. So that, I think, is a step in the right direction. And if you're going to reach millions of people, you've got to have something for all these people to attract them, and you've got to be something more like Rents, like a Mike Rivera, Mike's his first name, and some of these others that I could name. Even I'm not going to name Alex Jones, but that's what gets millions of people. And even if these millions of people come and look at the site, that doesn't mean that they're going to be influenced in the way you want them to be. But he doesn't want to offend people. He doesn't want to turn away people because of too much Nazi look. If they, you know, to, so that's how this site is going to change. It's going to become more generalized. It's pro-white, no question about it. It's pro-white, it's anti-Jew. That's not going to change. Much more so than Rents or Mike Rivera is, but it's still going to be something that is, I'm not saying it's going to be watered down. I'm saying that it's too much, there's so much variety. There's going to be, when you have something, you know, for everyone, or almost for everyone, then you don't have, you're not hitting on any one particular thing that hard, except the fact that blacks and whites don't get along and Jews are the problem in this society. Okay, that's been hit on for a long time, for quite a while by a lot of places. It hasn't done the job yet, but it might still. I'm just saying, you know, it's not my site, Daily Stormer. I don't even like it much anymore, but I do go and look at it, and I do want to check out if there's anything there that I'd, you know, be interested in, or very much like everybody does. Some people are regular commenters, but everybody that goes there, all these many, many, many people, it's to see if there's something new there that they don't want to miss. And so that's what Andrew has to keep doing. And he has to keep, it's all about something new. He has to keep pushing, he has to keep putting on new stories, because that's what people want. They don't want the same old story they already read. And a lot of people don't read much of it. They look at the pictures. It's a lot about images. And they read the headlines, and they read a few things. And then they come back later and look again to see if there's something new, or they might check into some comments to see what people are saying, things like that. But it's not making any heavy-duty impact when it gets to be like that, in my opinion. But there's something, you know, all these things are going to be around, and this turns out to be what Andrew Anglin's speed is, or what Andrew Anglin's capability is. It is as a propagandist, and it's doing this kind of propaganda, because he truly, I think he sincerely and honestly believes that he wants to reach as many people as possible. I don't know if within that idea there is the idea that this makes him more famous or more well known or whatever if he reaches a lot of people. But he states that he thinks this is what we need, and you know, I'll accept that. It's not the way I could ever do anything, and it's not what I like either, because as I mean, you can tell that already. I don't like the site as much as I used to. The newness, it's worn off, and I find it's just mostly more of the same. I've only been interested in his political shifts that have taken place, and I've really been interested in his loss of interest in being a big bad Nazi. And so that's going by the wayside. And if he does get a new, more white nationalist type banner, I will applaud it, and I will be glad that he did, because I think that he's kind of misusing the nationalist socialist theme, and he has been for quite a long time. In fact, my favorite comment there is this one by Wolf, and I'm going to read it to you. Why it's my favorite, kind of explains some things. And he quotes Andrew in the article as saying, "Though I am a fascist and we openly promote Hitler and National Socialism constantly on this site, several people have told me that the bombers are offensive to British people, and I have decided this is fair enough." Well, Wolf says fascism and National Socialism is two different ideologies. Why would the German bombers be offensive to British people? I mean, he's kind of got two different ideas in that sentence. So but he asked a good question, why they would be. Then he says, but here's the best part. He says to Andrew, then do not promote National Socialism, Adolf Hitler, and fascism, Mussolini, at all. If people are going to be offended by it, and we don't want to do what I guess he means, if you don't want to do what people are offended by, don't promote any of it. But then the better part is, he says, get an image of white nationalism with no design theft of anything remotely to do with these ideologies, and create an ideology catering specifically for white nationalism. Once again, base it on your own creativity and nothing to do with National Socialism or fascism. As for Julius Streicher's Der Stürmer, his standards are way up there. Now, well, then he ends by saying, speaking as a German, feeling offended. I don't know. Now, that will be a competition. He means that will be a competition if people are not, I think, people are not going to be taking all their images from National Socialist or fascist work that's already been done. And I've made the same complaints about Andrew, that everything is taken from these big movements and things that people have done, and then he kind of wraps himself in it, like pictures of Hitler and German World War II soldiers and so on, you know, kind of ad nauseam. I don't think you can get tired of those, but I don't mean that, but I mean he does it so much. And everything is kind of stolen. I mean, Wolf is putting it in words here. If I said that, you see, everybody would jump on me. Everything I say, I write on that site, all these men jump on me, or these boys and guys jump on me and attack me for being rude, not having a right to say what I'm saying. But if a guy says it, and they do say it, and here's Wolf saying it, nobody complains about it. That's just the way it works there. So I got tired of that, and I've given up posting my good advice on there. But I agree with Wolf here that, and I really wish people would use their real names. I really do, but they don't, so what the heck. I agree with him that it's there's too much theft, that he's stealing from other places, and they steal other people's designs, and they don't come up with their own. And he's saying, come up with something original of your own. Well, let's see if anybody does, or what's come. I'm kind of following this with interest, because I'd like to see what it ends up being, since I've had some, you know, I've complained about that banner myself in the past, because it's, and my point was that the site didn't live up to what the banner says it is. And so he needs to get a different banner that reflects the site, which is more of a white nationalist philosophy. So, moving on into what National Socialism is and isn't. I want to talk about fascism a little bit and say that National Socialism is not fascism, but it can be considered, I guess, a form of fascism or including fascism, certain ideas about certain tenets of fascism, because the main difference that I see is that National Socialism refers to the folk, which is the nation, and fascism refers to the state. But people write about it in all different kinds of ways. People will write about National Socialism in the state, and they'll write about fascism in the folk. Or they won't use the word folk, maybe, but they'll use the word the people, the nation, and so on. But here, this fellow, I'm not recommending this man, but he wrote about fascism. Albert Weisbrod, probably a Jew, wrote, the state must have definite territorial boundaries. Well, he could be a German and not a Jew, possible. The state must have definite territorial boundaries. If there is no private property in war, and no war, there can be no state. If there is no state, there can be no nation. The state is not the product of the nation. The nation is the product of the state. In other words, the nation must not only have a common kindred base, but be composed of both rulers and ruled, bound together by blood ties and having a common language, heritage, tradition, culture, and set of customs. Well, he is saying that the nation is created by the state. It's a product of the state. But he's also bringing in that the people of the state have to be bound by blood ties and language, heritage, tradition, culture, and sets of customs. But I take this then to mean that the state determines what that is. That the state says, well, you're all one blood, or you're all, we're going to speak this language, and everybody's going to speak this language, and we're going to use these traditions, we're going to follow this culture, and whoever is a member of that state, that fascist state, has to go along with that. But Hitler says it differently. And he says that the state, and has said that the state, was the product of the nation. And he made that very clear in some speeches that he gave in the 1930s. And that he would say, I want to remind you, don't make any, there's no mistake about it. The nation is not produced by, or he, how would he have said it? He would have said, the state doesn't control the nation or rule the nation or anything, but it's the nation that controls the state, or it's the nation that creates the state. The nation comes first, the nation being the people, not just the people, but the folk. Whereas in fascism, it's worded the other way around. Fascism asserts that stronger nations have the right to expand their territory by displacing weaker nations. And this guy Stackelberg places fascism on the right, and he includes Nazism. They like to call it Nazism, which is, I guess, Hitler's National Socialism. He includes Nazism as a radical variant of fascism, both on the right, explaining that the more a person deems absolute equality among all people to be a desirable condition, the further left he or she will be on the ideological spectrum. The more a person considers inequality to be unavoidable and even desirable, or or unavoidable or desirable, right, inequality, the further to the right he or she will be. We have a lot of people today who would have been on the right or seem to be coming from the right, moving to the left or talking about engaging the left and even embracing certain aspects of the left. And I don't know where to put this in here. I think I'll put it right here. I'll just say it right here, that this idea of equality is what it all comes down to. And if you, the more that, as it says here, the more you desire equality as a good thing, the more to the left, and the other way, the more to the right. These people that I'm talking about who are moving to the left a little bit, or a lot in some cases, a lot, are generally white nationalists. They believe in white nationalism, whereas I'm talking here, see, about National Socialism. And I brought up that the banner of Andrew Anglin's Daily Stormer as being a Nazi design, totally National Socialist design and symbols on it, Wolf saying it should be more white nationalist, and me agreeing with that, that to fit the site, it should be more white nationalist. And these people who are, the only people that I know that are engaging the left to some degree are white nationalists. They're not National Socialists, and they're not even pure nationalists. They're white nationalists, which to me is a more, also brings in the idea of equality. Within, I've brought this up before. I get criticized for it. I get in trouble for it. I'm not against white nationalism, but I can see that white nationalism, I brought up the idea of political correctness, and I'm still troubled with that, and I'm still working on that. I still see that more and more clearly, that in white nationalism, the idea that is the idea that we have to have equality among whites, and if anything that is not, that questions the equality between white people is really horrible. You know, it just is just the same way that the left thinks that if you speak about the inequality amongst races, it's just terrible. Oh, horrible, racist, terrible to think that one race is superior to another or so different that the other race can't be a part of that race or can't function along the same lines or side by side, what have you. This is what white nationalists not only decry this, but they ridicule it. And they say, gosh, you know, these stupid leftists, you know, with all their equality, we know that there's no equality in the world and there's no equality anywhere. And yet, these same people, when it comes to the various white nationalities, can't deal with inequality. They don't want it to be there. They can't handle it, and they find it very, very offensive. And they attack people who would suggest such a thing. This whole question about the equality thing interests me from this angle. And I will go on just with some information about National Socialism, where it comes from and what it's based on. And then you can see for yourself where this equality comes in or doesn't come in. So some people think that National Socialism is a type of fascism that incorporates scientific racism and anti-Semitism. So a type of fascism that incorporates scientific racism and anti-Semitism, because these two things are not necessarily found always in fascism, but they must be a part of National Socialism. I go along with this. I wrote this, but some of it came from somewhere, but I wrote part of it, that fascism has not always been particularly racist, and it is not always anti-Semitic or anti-Jew, but National Socialism is and must be, in my estimation, or you better call it something else. Because national implies that it's based on race and on ethnicity and language, culture, etc. At the base of it, not because people have learned to speak the same language, but because they are of the same blood. And the anti-Semitism is necessary in true nationalism because the Jews don't fit into a nationalist state, and they certainly don't agree with the thinking of a nationalist state. So if they pretend like they do, they're lying and they're playing games with you. So the original influences for National Socialism, as we've all read about and been told previously, were Pan-Germanism, for one, two, Volkish German Nationalist Movement. We're talking about German National Socialism. Pan-Germanism, the Pan-Germanism Movement, the Volkish German Nationalist Movement, the anti-communist Freikorps paramilitary culture at the end of the First World War, and then the humiliation of the Treaty of Versailles, number four. Those four things, basically. And when it comes to the Volkish German Nationalist Movement, one of the most significant ideological influences on the Nazis was the German nationalist Johann Gottlieb Fichte, F-I-C-H-T-E, whose works served as an inspiration to Hitler and other Nazi members, including Dietrich Eckert and Arnold Funk, F-A-N-C-K. Arnold Funk was a movie maker, a filmmaker, who was amongst the early National Socialists. And this man came along. Put out his speeches to the German nation in 1808. He was before their time, really. He inspired them. It was written amid the Napoleonic France's occupation of Berlin. All right, France occupied Berlin during that time under Napoleon, and Fichte called for a German national revolution against the French occupiers. I guess he was very passionate. He made passionate speeches in public. He stressed the need for action by the German nation to free itself. He spoke of the need of a people's war, a Volkskrieg. He promoted German exceptionalism, and he stressed the need for the German nation to be purified, including purging the German language of French words, a policy that the Nazis undertook when they came to power. They actually were cleaning up the German language of, I guess they had too many French words and also some English words, and any words that weren't German. Germany was a young nation when it was unified. Of course, it's old, but unified Germany under Bismarck was a kind of new and considered to be a young nation, full of energy and, learning to identify itself. So you can understand the kind of extremes that they would go to and the passion they would have to find who they were and to, focus on who they were, and that being very important, which today and even then amongst many people, including Jewish interests, that was not a good thing, and that was a that was a dangerous thing to be focused on your nationality so much and all of that. So, but you can understand why it was, and it's continued on that way even under Hitler, that the Germans felt they wanted to know themselves and they wanted to see what they could accomplish and they wanted to be proud of themselves and all of these various things. The Germans have been kind of held down for forever. You know, they've always been surrounded by other nations that worry about them being too strong and not wanting them to be too strong. So they're always, in my estimation, being pushed down and not allowed to have to do the things that these other nations have done for their own glory and so on, but not the Germans. So this was the situation here with this Fichte. He was really a firebrand, I guess. And after him came, I have a little note here that probably something I think is interesting. Oh, yeah, I'm saying it's possible that things like this, like this Fichte, gave impetus to the Jewish community to appear Germanized, especially culturally, and it worked. Oh, yeah, well, you know, at that time, then I go on to say it was when the Eastern Jews showed up after World War I that the Germans recognized the offensive Jew as different from themselves. Well, what I was seeing there was that when this German nationalism, you know, cropped up and got very strong and people like Fichte were making speeches talking about the German revolution against anything that was non-German and so on, that this caused the Jews, who were quite a lot of them there, to try to appear to, even more than ever, to be German. And they did do that. You know, the German Jews were very well integrated because they tried to be integrated. They tried to pass themselves off as Germans of the Jewish religion. Germans didn't notice the Jews that much. They didn't see them as a problem as much as they should have. But after World War I, when those Eastern Jews started invading the country, they weren't trying to be to fit in. They didn't even know anything about that. They were just what they were, and they became very offensive to the Germans. That's when the Germans started to see what the Jew was. They didn't see it before that. Now, the next person that I can mention here is Arthur de Goethe. I didn't check out how to pronounce his name. I just think I know, but I might not know. Gobineau, Arthur de Gobineau, who's known for his racial theories, and he was French, though. He wasn't German, and he blamed the French the fall of the French the troubles in France. He blamed it on the regime that allowed Napoleons to come in and so on. He blamed it on racial degeneracy, which was caused by racial intermixing. Which he's right about that. He decided that the French were a lost cause, even though he was French, because of all the racial mixing that had already gone on, and he thought that the Germans had retained the purity of race, and he attracted a strong following therefore in Germany. Talking about needing to preserve the Aryan race and so on. And he emphasized the existence of an irreconcilable polarity between Aryan Germanics and the Jewish culture. He equated the Aryan with the Germanic, because the others were too polluted already. He thought the Germans were the only ones that still retained that Aryan, and not just Germans, but the Germanic peoples of Europe. And he contrasted that with the Jews and Jewish culture. You know, Horst Mahler does that today. And that was Hitler's idea, too. Hitler talked about the Aryan a lot in Mein Kampf, and by which he was really referring to the Germans, for the most part. Not that he ever defined and says, well, Aryans are just German, because he wouldn't have said that or believed that, but at the same time, for all practical purposes, you might say, the Aryan meant the German. Well, after de Gobineau, there was also another foreigner, Englishman, Houston Stuart Chamberlain, who was also found the Germans to be the people he liked best, and he praised them for their creativity and idealism, while asserting that the Germanic spirit was threatened by a Jewish spirit of selfishness and materialism. And he wrote the book Foundations of the 19th Century. It came out in 1899. That was a big influence in Germany and on Adolf Hitler and Eckart and that whole crowd. In fact, he was associated with the National Socialists, even personally. And the empirical evidence does demonstrate that from 1871, at the time of the German unification under Bismarck, the Reich, to the early 20th century, that German Jews were overrepresented in Germany's upper and middle classes and underrepresented in Germany's lower class, particularly in the fields of agricultural and industrial labor. And that German Jewish financiers who were so well integrated into the German scene, and the bankers, the financiers and bankers played a key role in fostering Germany's economic growth from 1871 to 1913. There was a big boom, and while Germany had great economic boom, these Jewish financiers and bankers all benefited enormously from this very boom, more than anybody else. And I thought then about this, that this could very well, this certainly contributed to England feeling threatened by Germany. And that helped to lead to World War I. If you will recall some of the other programs I've done on World War I, and the most recent with Paul Hickman, we spoke about this a little bit, but I will be going into this a lot more in the future, but yeah, I hope so. I hope to do so anyway. But we know that Germany was experiencing this big, I mean, it was too fast, you know. Germany was just coming on like gangbusters, and it was because these Jewish bankers and financial people were loaning money and were you know, making it possible for it to happen. You know, if you want to have a boom, you need to have money being loaned. If you want to create a bust, you deprive the economy of the money that it needs. And these Jews are in charge of all that. And so I really think that this is connected, because we know that they wanted a war. And they're in England, they're in Germany, they're all over, they're connected with all the governments, and they know exactly what's going on. They're in Russia, they're everywhere. So they're creating this big boom, and Germany is really happy and flexing its muscles and so on. But this is making England nervous and very upset. And then we end up, at the end of this boom in 1913, we end up in 1914 with this war being declared. And this war destroyed Germany, destroyed the Germans, but it didn't destroy the Jews. And I checked it out, and the cost of this little episode was 37 million dead. 37 million white Europeans, civilians and military, killed, so that the Jews, in my estimation, could have this war, which helped them to set the stage for gaining Palestine. Now, sure, they want to make money, but they also, and they want to control things as much as possible, but they also had this goal of getting their Zion in Palestine, and they made steps toward that. They didn't actually get there yet, but they partially got there, and they had a big, they made a lot of positive moves toward that and had a lot of promises and so on. And as far as this goes, Wilf Hienck told me of a historian who states that Germany should have allied with Russia against England in World War I, not with Austria-Hungary. That if Germany had allied with Russia against England, there wouldn't have been a World War I. But Germany allied with Austria-Hungary against Russia. Now, do you think that the Jews could have had anything to do with that fact, that that didn't happen, that people couldn't see what was best in their best interest for various reasons, that things don't pan out the way the intelligence would show you to do it? And these, you know, we're not unintelligent. You know, there was that assassination of Ferdinand, the Archduke, down in Serbia. You know, could that be somewhat related to that too? That caused a big furor in Austria-Hungary. So then Germany felt they had to stand by their German-Austrians, their Austrian-Germans or whatever, and all of these things. But there's people pushing for it, pushing it to go one way or the other in the background. So I have a lot of stuff I could say, but at this point I wanted to do some summing up, but I never got around to my putting together my summing up. But I think just the best that I can do for now, because I'll probably have to save some of this other for another show, another time, that when we talk about the two necessary items in National Socialism that I brought out earlier, one being anti-Semitism, what I've just been saying here in the last few minutes shows the necessity for that. That Jews are the spoilers, and Jews have to be gotten out of the population and out of the country. I mean, they've got to be not, they can't be a part of the nation, because no matter, in Germany, they had all these Jews who appeared to be really loyal Germans. You know, they were bankers and big businessmen and so on. And they were very pro-German. They were always pro-German. But what were they actually doing? Whether every one of them was fully cognizant of the purposes behind what they were doing or not, they were doing it. They were creating conditions for a war. And the other one, besides, I forgot already what it was. I probably know it. It's just obvious what it was, but... let's see, how far back do I have to go for that? I had anti-Semitism, and the other one was, I don't even know where that was. Let's see. I should be able to see it somewhere. Well, maybe it's just at the beginning of this little part that I did on fascism. It's not there. I'll forget about it. Racism. Scientific racism. I was going to say racism, and then I'm thinking, well, anti-Semitism and racism is the same thing, but it isn't. Scientific racism, that race matters, that just like you have to get the Jews out of your nation, you can't have other foreign elements in your nation if you're going to be, if your nation is based on your folk, your blood. And for an awful lot of people, more and more, this is becoming less important. We hear Jim Reinhard Hardpecka saying that, oh, we don't need to worry about that anymore. We want to, there's noble people in every race, and you'll probably find noble people in the Jews pretty soon, because everything is spiritual to him, and he's so new age that none of these things, it's not physical, it's spiritual. But I'm saying that everything is spiritual. My answer to that is that everything has a spiritual component. There is nothing that is physical that doesn't come from the spiritual. The spiritual is the actual creative, element. I mean, everything exists as spirit, also, as we do, people do. So it's to say that things are spiritual is kind of stupid, as though there's a difference between physical and spiritual when there really is no difference. But we're on a physical plane and we're dealing with things physically, and the physical reflects the spiritual, or the spiritual is expressed in the physical and vice versa. So to say that, well, we don't have to pay attention to the physical because we're moving into the age of Aquarius and we're just becoming so spiritual and everything is esotericism now and so on. That's just baloney and nonsense. Shouldn't be listened to either, because these people don't know what they're talking about. And we have to retain the racial element. We cannot expect that somehow spiritual qualities are going to override the physical racial qualities that that exist in people. So those two things have to be a part of National Socialism. And if they're not, it's not National Socialism. So that's as far as I'm going to go with that at the moment, because I'm going to move over, since I had decided to do it, and I'm interested in it, and I said I was going to do it. I'm going to move over to my genealogy and see how long it takes me to go through that. And if it doesn't take me too long, I can go back to the other topic before the end of the show. And I'd also like to invite people to call in tonight. There's plenty of time if you'd like to call and say anything about what I was talking about, but try to keep it clear and simple. I'm all of a sudden imagining Jim calling in, Jim Reinhard calling in, all excited, but maybe, I hope not. I don't think I want to hear from Jim, but I would like to hear from anybody who thinks they have something they'd like to say here, that they think I'm either all wet or I'm missing the boat, or there's something I need to know that I don't know. I welcome it. The phone number is 1 and then 323-642-1206. That's 323-462-1206. And I'll try to keep my eye over here where the calls show up so that I don't just ignore the whole thing. Let me look at my email and see if anything has come in on email. I don't think so. This looks like some junk from some Jew. This is no good. Okay, go back over here. All right, well, as I should preface this, I need to preface my genie, my family. I should just call it my family that I'm discovering, is not hard for me to do, because they all come from the same place, going back to the 1700s, and there's in a community, a German community in Hungary, it was Eastern Hungary at the time, and is now in Western Romania since the border lines were changed. But I discovered a few years ago, thanks to Wilhelm Christman, that there was some people in there in Nuremberg who put out this book who have researched all the records of my family and all the other people there in this community. It was called Saint Anna in English. It's Sant Anna in German. But now they call the place just Santana, like it's Spanish or something. Santana, but originally it was Saint Anna, and they went there as settlers, along with a lot of other German people, and mostly Southern German, but there could be some from, you know, a few coming from Northern Germany, who knows. But mostly there was Southern German and even more Southern German than Austrian. But it was at the request and behest of the Maria Theresa, the Empress of Austria-Hungary, the Queen of Hungary, and it was after the end of the war with the Turks, after the victory of that group that included the Austrians, who finally defeated the Turks in that area and drove them out. And now the land there had been fought on. It was kind of war, you know, beat up, and it was barren. It was empty. And they didn't want to leave it that way. They wanted people to settle there. And it was not easy they couldn't expect the local people to settle there because they were already settled where they were, and they didn't want to go there and do all that. So, and who were the best farmers and the best hardworking people to reclaim a land and make it fertile and worth something again? But the Germans. And this was her interest, and so she encouraged and gave, you know, promised land and other good things to Germans who would go there, and they arranged for all these barges to travel down the Danube River, which took them from where they were in northern Austria to all the way out there to through Hungary. And that's how they got there, and a whole lot of them went, and I've got stuff written about the town there and the settlers and all kinds of information, but I'm not going into that tonight. I don't even have it up on hand, actually. It's in some files. But my family took advantage of that. You know, my family are not, we're not wealthy people. There's no barons. There's no Vons. There's no nobility or aristocracy anywhere in my family line. They're just plain farm people. That's all. And I come to appreciate that more and more. You know, they never got spoiled. They never got... what's that called when you, they never deteriorated through too much indulgence. They were Catholic. And I relate very much to, actually, I've come to realize that I come from people that are very much the same as Adolf Hitler and his people, and the same, Austrian and Southern German, there's not a whole lot of difference. And I'm going to start with I'm just going to talk about the names in the family names in the line that I've put together so far of my two grandmothers, what they came from, I'm going to start with my maternal grandmother, because I know where these ancestors came from in Germany. I just discovered that from these books. Well, I don't know if I fully explained how this researcher, Alf Kurt, and his friend Joseph Lutz, who publishes the book and sells it, he's been doing this for at least 10 years. I mean, probably longer. I just have known what I know about it. I would say at least 10 years, and I don't know really how long. When I need to ask when the first one ever came out. But he keeps expanding, and he keeps getting more and more information. So I was trying to get this book for a couple of years already, or three, but I never contacted him at the right time. He'd say, "Well, there's a new book coming out in September." I'd say, "Okay, I want to get one. Let me know." Well, then sometime after September, I'd say, "Gee, I never heard." I'd write and say, "Is that book out yet?" And he'd say, "Oh, well, it already came out and we sold out." And so the next one will be next year. And this kind of thing was going on. Well, I finally, you know, made sure I stayed in contact. And so I ordered the newest version that just came out this spring. And that it was shipped to me from Nuremberg. And boy, they're two big books. The first half of the alphabet in one book and the second half of the alphabet in the other book. And they're both big, heavy books. And out of hardbound books. And at the front, it lists all the family names from Santana, and there are 363 family names. And some of the names, a few of the names are in boldface, and I figured out that meant they were not German names, because some of them are clearly not German. Some of them I wouldn't really be able to tell, but they're not really very German. So there are 62 of those. So 62 of the 363 names, excuse me, were not German names. But none of the ones in my family line that I've found at all are not German names. They're all German names. So I'm starting with my maternal grandmother, whose name was Barbara Reck, R-E-C-K. When I first heard my grandmother's name, I think it was, I don't know if it was after she died or before, but after, I think. I didn't like it. I thought, Reck, what kind of name is that? Didn't sound good. It didn't sound good to me. But I have come to realize that it's a perfectly respectable German name, and it has different spellings. It could be spelled R-E-C-H and sometimes R-E-K, but her spelling was R-E-C-K, and it may have been changed. It may have been changed after she came to the United States, because it sounds more like Reck, like it would be a K, not an H. But then again, she came and was, I don't know, she was married right away, so it could be the way they spelled it. So anyway, I'm fine with it now. The beginning of this line, you see, as far back as I can go about her, with her, goes back to Bauerbach, Germany. So this is the only one so far where I have a location in Germany. And the original ancestor that I know about was Johann Reck and Barbara. Actually, I don't know anything about those two. Just their names are there. Johann Reck and his wife Barbara, with no last name. That's not known because they don't have the records. See, these people go by the records in Santana. All the church has complete records there, and birth, death. That's mostly what they have, and marriage, birth, death, and marriage, and children. And of course, then all their children, birth. That's birth. And birth and death. So that's basically what's in this book. But supposedly, he thinks that it started, but he's got the children of this Johann Reck and Barbara, and the child is Johann Georg, but he was born in Bauerbach. Johann Georg was born in Bauerbach, and he died in Bauerbach, so I don't know how he got those, but he did. And then he married Barbara Stern in 1741. Johann Georg Reck was born in 1718. And he married Barbara Stern, S-T-U-R-N, in 1741 in Bauerbach, Germany. Now, Bauerbach is in the state of Baden, which is now Baden-Württemberg. But it's near Stuttgart. It's not that far. Maybe 20, no, that's the other place I'm thinking of. You know, it's a little bit northwest of Stuttgart. That's the closest big place to it. So I was very happy to find a place in Germany that they're from. Of course, Bauerbach, Bauer means farmer, and Bach is like a stream or a creek. So it could be, the name of the place could be like Farmer's Creek. You know, that's a normal kind of a place name. Farmer's Creek for this little village of Bauerbach that they came from. Of course, my grandmother didn't come from there, but her ancestors did. So, my grandmother's cooking was exactly like, so close to the cooking, the cuisine in that part of Germany. A couple years ago, I was reading about cuisine in different places that I thought might be where my grandparents came from, or not my grandparents, my ancestors of my grandparents originally came from. And when I was reading about Stuttgart, and the that's the Schwabish area, that's the Schwabish cuisine. It was so much like my grandmother's stuff. I thought that's it, and you know, it turned out to be right. Yeah, here I found out that's exactly where she did come from, where her family did come from. And these things are like, they pass it down. In my family, everything is passed down. People didn't come up with new ideas much. They pretty much did everything the same, generation after generation. That's how they stayed so pure, if I might say. So, because there's nothing but Germans in my family line. So this original Johann Reck, who's imagined here, had Johann Georg, and he married Barbara Stern in Bauerbach. Now, they had, we've got three children of theirs. No, two. They probably had more, but anyway, there's only two here. A girl who, I don't know what happened to her, but the one that counts is Johann Michael. He married Maria Eva Hauff, but he was Johann Georg's, it's not their children yet. He's Johann Georg's, you're all going to quit listening to me. He's his brother, but his brother moved to Hungary. Johann Georg's brother moved to Hungary with his wife, Eva Hauck, H-A-U-K, and they lived in Gyorok, Hungary. He died there in 1782. So there's records there for him. And Gyorok is close to Sant Anna. I looked it up on the map, and it's there. It's right next to the mountain, the foothills of the mountains that start, that's now in Romania. And it's only about 20 kilometers from Sant Anna. But I guess Sant Anna was a German town, and Gyorok would have been a Hungarian place, but some of the Germans lived there. So it probably was more developed and more work there, maybe. Anyway, that's where he died, in Gyorok. But then, now, speaking about Johann Georg and Barbara Stern's children, that's where my ancestor comes in. They had several children, but the one that counts is my ancestor is Andreas, who was born in 1764, and he was a tanner. He would have been born in Bauerbach, but he also went to Hungary. And he died in 1831 in Santana. And he married, in Santana, he married Maria Caterina Silberreis. I guess that's S-I-L-B-E-R-E-I-S. They married in Santana in 1791. So Andreas and Maria Caterina are some kind of great-great-great-grandparents of mine. Then Andreas and Maria Caterina had children, of course. They had quite a lot of children. But the one, I'll only mention the one that's my ancestor. Of course, a lot of these children died very early, either at birth or in the first months or the first couple of years. It's just terrible how many of these children died out there. Sometimes it's really tragic. I already mentioned one, I think. Or maybe I haven't. No, I haven't, but I will. Where they had 15 children, only five lived past the age of four. That was a bad time. Anyway, Andreas and Maria Caterina, after quite a number, their third or fourth son was who survived was Franz. He came along later, Franz. He wasn't born until 1813, and he only lived until 1857, but he married, he was in Georg too, and he was a smith, and he married Anna. Now, most of these people were, my ancestors were all like, they had some farm, they had their farmland, and then they had a trade too. And sometimes I think that one son was the main one who got the farm or ran the farm, and the others kind of helped out, plus they had a trade because they weren't the main inheritor of the father. So I think that's how it worked out. But he married Anna Eckstein, E-C-K-S-T-E-I-N, but they were only married for like a year, and then he married Theresia Schauer, C-H-A-U-E-R. Maybe the first one died, like in childbirth or something. And he married, this Theresia is what they call everybody, but it would be like, it would be Teresa. Teresa Schauer, S-C-H-A-U-E-R. In 1852, then he died in 1850. Let's see, I get this mixed up. He died in 1857. So after he died, she remarried and moved to another town, Villagos. And then they had another daughter who was a cooper and married Joseph Lewis. Well, I'm not going to go into the brothers and sisters, but the children of Franz and Theresa Schauer. The only one that counts is my ancestor. His name was August, A-U-G-U-S-T. And he was also born in Georg. So they are all staying over there in Georg, the Rex. And he lived to be 65 years old. He was a wagon maker. And he married Barbara Hell, H-E-L-L, in 1882. You know, the name Hell was another name I didn't like when I first saw it. I thought, what kind of name is that? But, of course, I've seen it since in German literature. Germans named Hell. And then there's a lot of things like Hellman and Hellstrom and all of that. Made me think then of... Rudolf Hess, who there are other German names like Hessmeyer and Hess something else, Hess this, but his is only Hess. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with that name either, although, and of course, it's in German, I don't know, it means something else, but I was a little bit worried, I suppose, about my family, what I would find, and so I was a little critical, but I'm not anymore. I know there's nothing wrong with any of these names or any of these people. Well, I'm sure they're not perfect, but anyway, August and Barbara Hell had quite a lot of children. Well, he lived to be 65, see, and she seemed to be a good, strong woman, and they had a lot of children, although a lot of them died young. But the second child they had, and the first one who survived, was my grandmother, Barbara. So she was named after her mother, and she was born in 1884, and she married Anton Schillinger in 1906 in Chicago. And that's my grandfather. And then her sister, her younger sister, was born in 1896. She was like almost 12 years older than her sister. But I knew her too. She married my grandfather's brother. This happened a lot in these families with these people. One of them married somebody in a family, and then the families got to know each other, and then somebody married another person married somebody in that family. So in this case, my grandfather and his brother married what was my grandmother and her sister. See, and they came to the U.S. too, and I knew them. Quite well. So that's the end of the story. That's the end of the names of my maternal grandmother. Now I'm going to go to my paternal grandmother, and her name was Barbara too, but her last name was Schmidt, Schmidt. And the earliest ancestor that's in the book is Sebastian Schmidt, who was born around 1740, but in Santana, and he was a farmer there, naturally, and he married a Rosalia, but there's no last name for Rosalia. That wasn't recorded, I guess, but amongst their children, they had quite a lot of children too. My ancestor is Joseph, who was not the first son, the second son who survived, and he was a farmer. Maybe he got the farm, I don't know. He married Francisca Abfalter, Abfalter, and they had a good long marriage, and they're the ones that had the 15 children, of which only five lived past their fourth year. My goodness. But they all went on to marry and have families of their own, I assume. Anyway, their firstborn was Michael, and that's my ancestor. He was born in 1804, and he married Katharina Sham, S-C-H-A-M, there in Santana. And then they went on to have six children, Michael and Katharina. And the second son that survived was Anton. That's my ancestor, who's also listed as a farmer, born in 1833, and he married Teresa Emeneth. Of course, here's Theresia Emeneth, E-M-E-N-E-T-H, in 1852. He has a sister, Maria Magdalena, who married, she's called a farmer, a barin, a female farmer. She married Michael Genozzi. See, now there's a foreign name, Genozzi. It's not German. It's probably Hungarian. But anyway, I'm not from her bloodline, from that bloodline, Michael Genozzi. So that doesn't affect me any. But all the other names that I see that our sisters and brothers have married. I'm not giving them all, but they're all German, except this one I just mentioned here. And then earlier, somebody married somebody with a Hungarian name, or that might, no, that's not coming up because I'm already through that. So then Anton and Teresa Emanet Schmidt had three children, and did I already do that? No, and the first one, the firstborn was Michael. Now, they might have had more, but they're not on here. I don't know, because I've got, well, all I've got here is Michael, and then two, oh, I think, let's see. That was a different person. I get these, there's so many of the same names, I get them mixed up. But he married, okay, Michael, yeah, okay, this is it. Michael died young at the age of 36. He's listed as a farmer. This is kind of sad before Anton and Teresa here. They have only three children listed. Michael died at 36, and the other two girl babies, died at 2 days and 2 weeks. So maybe they just didn't have, and he died at 36, so maybe, I think I checked how old he was when he got married. He was already a little bit older, so I guess he didn't live long enough for them to do a lot. But he married Teresa Totterer, Totterer, and after he died, she married a Mr. Hennigus, and she went to the United States with Mr. Hennigus and her two daughters, one of which was my grandmother. So this Teresa Totterer was my great-grandmother, and Michael, who died at the age of 36, is my great-grandfather. So my grandmother then, they had, wait a minute. See, I cut out the, what I did is I went to another page and I'm wrong about their children. They had more children than that. They had Michael and these two little girls who died very young. And then they had, Now I'm looking at, Now I'm looking at Michael and Teresa's children. They had four children. Michael and Teresa Totterer. They had Rose, who I met, my grandmother's sister. They had Sebastian, who died at 4 months. They had Barbara, my grandmother. See, both of my grandmother's names were Barbara. And they had Teresa, who died at 2 years. So the only two who survived of Michael and Teresa were Rosalia, or Rose and Barbara. So the story, and Barbara married Stefan Jaeger, spelled here J umlaut A G E R, in 1907 in my hometown, and that's where they came. That's where a bunch of these Germans from Santana settled in my hometown. I'm not saying what it is. And so they all knew each other there, and I grew up knowing them all, and all of that, and I knew that my grandmother was related to the Hennigus family through marriage, because her name remained Schmidt, but she soon became Barbara Jaeger. Her mother was Hennigus. Then there were no Totterers there. But this Rose came to visit once. She lived in Missouri, and she was, she was just 4 years older than my grandmother, her sister. But she was unmarried. They don't show any husband or anything for her, but they just say that she died in Missouri. There's not even a date. I guess nobody ever, they weren't able to find out the date. nobody ever sent it to them. But I remember as a kid, grade school, I guess, Grandma's sister came over with her. We didn't even know she had a sister. We didn't think much of her, but she was nice enough. She was real friendly. We didn't think she looked too good. But she lived down there in Missouri. Was kind of like on her own, you know, and she was a real tough lady, you know. She took care of everything. She was kind of like a hillbilly, I think, Ozarks or something. But she probably did all right. I don't know. I know that we were kind of giggling about her because there wasn't. We thought that we couldn't imagine that Grandma had a sister and what this sister was like. But I feel bad now. I wish I would have gotten to know Rose. I wish I would have known a lot of these people. There's nothing wrong with her. She was a hardworking woman. Everybody was hardworking. All these people were so darn hardworking. When I think about it, all that they did, they played too. They had fun. They had big dances, and they polked, and they drank and played cards, and socialized quite a lot. There was a lot of socializing going on, and they all kept up together, and they were all Catholic. So here I am closing in on the end of the show, as I've told you. I've told you all these names because I wanted to, for some reason, show that they are all German names in my family line. And I've already done my father's father's line, my paternal grandfather's line. I did that a couple years ago. Actually, I didn't have the books, but Alf Kurt, the researcher, sent all the information to me. It was nice of him because I couldn't get the book, and so he did that for me. And I have that, and that's all German too. It's pretty long. And then I haven't done my other grandfather yet. His name was Schillinger, and I haven't gone through the Schillingers yet. I'm going to find that interesting, but I'm sure they're all going to be German too, because that's the way these people were. They didn't marry outside their own kind. They lived pretty simple lives, particularly if you go back far enough. What did they have to do? You know, they found ways to entertain themselves, though, and it was always dancing. If you think about Southern Germans, you know that they are even now jovial people, dancers, beer drinkers. In my family group, the men played cards. Sometimes the women played cards too. So I suppose that's something they had. I don't know how far back card playing goes, but I suppose they always did that for their leisure time. What leisure time they had. They were faithful to the church. And everybody married. I was thinking about that today, how it's very rare. I haven't found a case where somebody didn't marry. There were some people that didn't marry, like this Rose, my grandmother's sister, Rose. Not everybody, I guess she never did marry. How did she get over here? I don't know how that happened. I don't know anything because I didn't ask the questions I needed to ask at the time. It never even occurred to me. My life was busy with other things, and things like this weren't not something that I thought about. And now, just like now, I'm so busy all the time with everything I do on the internet and all kinds of other things I never think about. Only that. That's too bad, but it's the way it goes. But they were, if you didn't marry, well, you're kind of up a creek, you know, because you needed to have a spouse. Life was hard. There was no welfare. Nobody was helping you out. You had to have children, too. They didn't even think about it. they had children. They just never used any contraception. And as soon as one was born, there'd pretty soon be another one on the way, seemed like, unless there was reasons why it didn't happen. I realized the families got smaller, so maybe they did start, got more closer to recent times, but they're not that much smaller. Even my grandparents on my father's side, they had five children, but the youngest one died at 2 years from diphtheria, from a diphtheria epidemic that was going around then. Too bad. It's sad. But the other four, you know, they survived. Then they started surviving, and when children started surviving, they didn't have so many. But they had to marry because they needed children to help out, and then they needed children to look after them in their old age, and they needed to be married for that. And a man without a wife was, you know, needed all the work that the wife did, and the woman wanted a man to, you know, to have a household. Couldn't be by herself too well. So that's the way it was then, and that's why the line went on and continued on so well. And now look at me, you know, I just didn't carry it on. Too bad. I got stuck in the, I'm going to blame the Jews here. I got stuck in the cultural revolution of the Marxist cultural revolution, and was such a independent thinker and so on that my life went differently. I never decided not to have children. It just didn't ever happen in the right way. And I thought things had to happen in the right way. So, but I it's true that I never had a powerful urge or never thought that was the goal of my life. So because I didn't think that, it didn't occur. But in any case, I've enjoyed my life, and I really am happy that I was able to find out about all these ancestors of mine. It's so easy to do because they all came, like I said, they're all in the same place, and somebody has checked out that whole place. And so I don't have to go hunting all over for connections to relations, and there's also not much mystery about it because, as you can see, they're all the same. Pretty much they're all the same. Not much variety there in the way of outside people and foreign elements and so on. But for that, what's good about that, all right, I have to quit. What's good about that is that they stayed racially pure. And I myself can be today a 100% racial German. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for listening to this crazy show tonight. I'm going to say goodbye for now and wish you a good week.